John Dibdol writes, "While the core of this incident starkly portrays human weakness and sin, our gaze must not rest solely on shame. Notice where God is in the story. How does he respond to the people and to his designated leader, Moses? Yahweh's response should give hope to all who recall too clearly their personal golden calves." Welcome to The Good Word. We continue our series on the book of Exodus. I am your host, Chiagua Heiss, and I am joined by my conversation partners, Dr. Matilda Fry and Dr. Jody Washburn. Here we are, friends. The golden calf incident happened in Exodus chapter 32, and our lesson this week covers chapter 33 and 34. What does it say about God that God chooses to rewrite the covenant rather than to cancel it? And how do we experience rewriting moments in our relationship with God even today? So before the rebuilding or the building of the sanctuary, something needs to happen with the people. And what happens here in our text that leads the people toward that direction?
We did not fully finish chapter 32 last week.
That's true.
And so that is why we are now in this predicament of chapter 33.
So let's go back, Matilda. Lead us back.
Because, you see, while we saw Moses in this exemplary role of an intercessor when he was up on the mountain with God, his way of dealing with the people when he came down is surely not exemplary.
Yeah, very different
story. It's very different. He expresses his anger in an extreme way, and then it is Moses that issues this command to kill. And we leave chapter 32 with a community, with a people that are completely divided, segregated in their tents, each one of them. They are not able to look at each other's faces anymore. They don't see the neighbor, the friend, the brother, because they killed him. And so chapter 33 now gives us the next step in this work that has to come to the point that we can call it reconciliation.
Yeah.
How do you come from a place where you have killed the other to a place where you can build a tabernacle and invite God
to come in? It's almost, Matilda and Jody, as if the golden calf itself wasn't the worst thing that happened in that chapter. Right? I mean, the golden calf was just a precedent to something much deeper, which is the breaking of this community through violence and murder, and doing it in such a way that you really hit rock bottom here, that there is no hope whatsoever of a people coming together after something like this. How do you rebuild? And I'm thinking here of all of these stories of genocide in the past. How do you rebuild a society that has seen that kind of a violence, that has isolated? I love the way you put it, Matilda, the inability to see the face of the other, right? Miroslav Volf talks about it in Exclusion and Embrace, right? This, how can we rebuild again? How can we embrace the one who has done such a harm toward us? So I love that we're back there, Matilda, because it's truly acknowledging the rock bottomness of this situation that we can move into these chapters now. Question then becomes, out of idolatry, out of deep violence commanded by the leader who was just previously interceding for the people, where do we go from here? So following John Dibdol's quote, where is God? How does he deal with his leader? And how does he move him first toward what God will expect from the people later? Reconciliation.
At the beginning of chapter 33, we learn about the people that they are in deep remorse. And they give out their ornaments and so on. They strip them off. And then we learn about Moses pitching a tent outside of the camp at a distance. And then he would go in and out from the camp into the tent and then come back again. And then pay attention to verse 8. It came about whenever Moses went out to the tent that all the people would arise and stand, each at the entrance of his tent, and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent. And then Moses enters the tent, and the Lord speaks to him, and then they all see the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, and they arise and they worship, each at the entrance of his tent. Now people are able to look out, to come out of their tents, to worship God, each at their entrance of the tent. There is still a distance between them, but there is the first step of looking out outside of your own, where you are, in your of yourself, your own place.
Yeah.
And probably seeing that the next tent, the neighbor, is also out on either side.
Yeah.
And so there is the first step to look at the other again and recognize there is still a neighbor, a brother, a friend.
Yeah. But this is all, am I, correct me if I'm wrong, Matilda, but isn't this all triggered by the one who committed the mistake, maybe,
yes,
originally, that now goes back to intercede for the people? So there's almost a beautiful theological point that could be made here, that the beginning of the rebinding of the community begins with a gaze toward the one who intercedes for them. So it's almost like this anticipates later, you know, what will happen in Jesus, that in keeping our eyes in toward our intercessor, we gain a greater sense of our belonging to each other and the community that we should cherish together.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful insight there. So out of this experience of Moses going into the tent and experiencing God, we have what the lesson brings up. And I think the whole point of the lesson is just to disclose who truly God is to Moses. Why is that so significant, a new revelation of who God is at this specific moment? What's the didactic emphasis here at this section of the book, considering the context that we just brought up?
Maybe the one who is the leader, the intercessor, it is not enough to be an intercessor on a vertical line between heaven and earth, earth and heaven.
Yeah.
You also need to become the intercessor on the horizontal level.
Mm.
And so the Moses who goes from the camp into the tent is important for the people down there in their miserable human state of being. And now he is also in need to learn that element as well.
Mm.
And so he takes the vertical route again. He goes up the mountain and he asks to find favor with God and to see his presence, his face. And God promises, I will do that. He puts him into the cleft of the rock in the next part there. Right?
Yeah.
And Moses looks out. And I love the expression, the cleft of the rock is the socket of your eye, in your skull, in your face.
Mm.
Moses basically is the proverbial eye entirely, fully.
Mm.
And he looks out and he sees God, and God is passing by. You cannot see my face, you can only see my back.
Mm.
We always wonder about that
element. Yeah, the meaning of it.
Yes. I'm not sure if...
Give us your theory,
fully
Matilda.
Right, but my personal interpretation here is that when God passes by, God moves somewhere.
Mm.
And where God moves is, we already know that, he moves downwards.
Mm.
Downwards into that tent that Moses had set up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, logically, Moses can only see the back of God. And that, maybe, is the lesson that he needs to learn, that God moves towards the people.
I love that.
Towards the place where he's needed most.
I love that. And there's,
and that is the direction that he himself will have to go.
Oof.
Towards the people.
It's almost like
because
his faith.
Because then they are together.
His faith in the people needs to be rekindled. Is that what you're saying, Matilda? I love that. Because this brings me back to Exodus chapter 3 again and 4. Where we didn't mention this then, but this is maybe an appropriate moment to bring it up, is that this whole vision of the burning bush at the time, the fire that burns but doesn't consume the tree, it's almost, there's a sense in that as Moses gazes into God himself, he sees the condition of the people, that they're also burning in Egypt, but they won't be consumed. It's almost like he looks into God, but what he sees is not God. It's the condition of the people. The other time he learns that in that first encounter with God is in that whole weird episode of one of the signs that God is with him is when he places the hand in his cloak and it's sort of the leprosy sort of, which is a weird point there that reappears only later in Numbers with Miriam and that whole situation with the leprosy. And one of the rabbis that I've been reading mentions how that whole thing about the leprosy is in the context of Moses questioning that the people will believe that he was sent. And it's almost God giving him like a previous reprimand of saying, it's okay for you to question me, but don't question the people. As a leader, you have to believe in the people. So I love how in that original call of Moses, Matilda, maybe we have the seeds of that divine desire to say, if you look at me, you see the people. Don't question the people. As a leader, you can question me all day long, but you have to believe in the people. Now that we come to chapter 33, it's almost like God is bringing all of these things back. I'm going to move toward them to remind you of what this whole thing is all about. And that's the beginning of the reconciliation. So I love that, Matilda. That's beautiful. Jody, what are you thinking?
Two quick things. As we've read these last few chapters, I keep going back to this phrase. I think it may come from Rabbi Nahum Wardlev. I'm not completely sure. But the idea of covenant love involving dialogue, so that two-directional back and forth. And I see that there's this embodiment of covenant love in dialogue. And in a way, we could say Moses is standing on the feet of people like Abraham who dared to push back, right? To go back and forth, to barter with God. And I think that's important for us to sit with in our modern context, because I know at least a lot of teenagers in Western Christianity have taken in this sense that, like, I can't remain in relationship with God if I'm questioning.
Yeah.
That if I question, that means I'm
not obeying,
leaving the relationship. And so I think this is really important to sit with. And the other piece that I would say is that we have here in chapter 33 and 34, but the revelation of this very concise phrase, like, who is this God, you know, the Lord, God of compassion and gracious, etc. What strikes me is, Matilda, as you're talking, you're pointing out how this revelation is like bringing back this ability for the people to receive God's care, and for Moses to accept that God cares for the people, and for Moses to accept his role in being an extension of God's care for the people, or attention to. It always strikes me as so humorous in the book of Jonah, where you almost hear this exasperation. Yes. When Jonah cites this text, I hear a whiny tone. Oh, Lord, I knew you were a God who was gracious and compassionate, right? And then the book of Jonah ends with basically, are you okay with God caring?
My self-description.
About the cattle in Nineveh. And then you're just left with that question. Like, are you okay with God daring to ask you to see the humanity of someone that you cannot at this time see as human?
Yeah. Exodus 34, it is what some have called the John 3:16 of the Hebrew Bible, right? 34, verse 6, the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. When asked about the nature of God, God tells him that he does. It's a beautiful thing. Well, my friends, my thanks go to my conversation partners, Matilda and Jody, our program engineer, Corin Bailey, to all of you for listening and for the good word. I'm Chiago Ice.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.